Hello, and welcome to the Afro Reads podcast with your hosts,
Amara
and Ugochi.
Afro Reads is a book review podcast that was created out of our shared love for reading African fiction books.
We talk through its themes and try to tie its key messages to our African heritage, culture, and contemporary issues.
We invite you to turn the page and let's begin.
Welcome to the sixth episode of Afro Reads podcast. I hope you've been well and you've had a good week so far. I am your host, Amara, and I am joined today by Ugochi, our co-host, and we have a guest all the way from Zimbabwe. Her name is Rufaro Mbonelli, and she is just completing a degree in creative writing, her second degree. So we have a few icebreakers for her that I'm going to pass it on to Ugochi to lead on.
Awesome. Are you ready?
I'm ready.
Okay, let's answer the first thing that comes to your mind. Don't think too much about it.
Okay.
Here we go. What is a current issue in the world that concerns you the most?
Racism.
For your great-great-grandchildren, is there any wisdom you'd want to pass on to them?
Read the Bible every day.
What do you want to be remembered for?
Inspiring people.
That's what I have.
That was hard.
It was?
Yeah.
You answered it like a boss. Okay, I have one more.
Okay.
What did you want to be when you were like 10?
I wanted to be a businesswoman.
Why?
Because I just felt like that would make me more money.
At 10, you were already thinking that.
Yeah.
That's so awesome.
And I thought that I would be respected as like a businesswoman. But I actually started writing at a very young age.
So businesswoman, what did you want to be selling or doing to get your money?
I'm probably gonna offer services more than like selling products. Yeah, like hosting. I'm really good at hosting.
No, but at 10, did you think,
I didn't know what it entailed, but at 10, I knew that I'd figure it out. Mm. I was very confident in myself at a young age. Mm. I really believed like I could do anything.
See, I heard this really cool story. You guys have heard it too, about a girl in the US that went around school, like doing people's edges for, I think, $1. And she was 10. So she had like her tub of gel and her toothbrush. Mm-hmm. And she just went around doing her friend's hair at that young age for like $1. I just thought that story was cool.
Yeah. Sometimes it's in people. Yeah, it's actually interesting because that's what like the character is, isn't it? She's got it in her.
Yeah. All right, so coming up to current events, a lot of things have happened this week. What stands out the most for you guys? So we'll start with our guest, Rufi. What has been going on this week? What has stood out for you?
Well, yesterday I had morning lecture. We talked about, you know, the report, the racism report.
Yeah, the race report. Yes, yes.
Obviously, I heard about it in the news, like briefly, and I kind of just ignored it because I was like, bunch of nonsense. But then I found out yesterday it was people of color that wrote that.
Yeah.
I was irritated. They basically said that Britain is like the exemplary country for racism and that there's no systematic racism in this country. Hmm. No racism in this country. No one of color would agree with that statement ever. Yeah. And they focused a lot on like your ability to be successful, and your ability to be successful in a country has nothing to do with racism, because you experience racism at the top level, wherever you're at, whether you're a CEO. But these people, like they're close friends of Boris, they know Boris. And it's like one of the guy, the lead guy, he's like a token black guy.
Face was everywhere. When you see the race report, you see his face to show that, you know, it's legit. When I saw people's comments on, oh my God, this race report is racism itself, I was like, yeah, I don't want to comment or I don't want to form opinions because I haven't read the report. The report's like 300 and something pages. But I read like some excerpts because people were posting it online and it was saying stuff about slavery. I've forgotten what it said.
Oh yeah, it said that the perspective of slavery should change. Oh, this is excellent. This is excellent because it's so trash.
Yeah.
Perception of racism should change. We should look at it as that we survived that, and that because we survived that, like we're great.
Yeah, something like that.
We shouldn't look at it as this negative thing. Like you cannot tell me that the years of oppression and psychological warfare that you put on us, I can just click my fingers and say we're survivors. That's all there is.
Yeah, and he was saying something about like the British Empire, and then you should be proud and happy that you've been westernized kind of thing. Oh, there wow. should be no complaint that, yeah, it was an excerpt. I don't know the exact words. I'm very, very particular about like taking things out of context. Yeah. I was like, this is just really sad because they politicized it.
I need to read about it.
Yeah. Ugochi, I'm sure you have a lot to say.
Yeah. Really good. I'm going to write a letter to that guy. I want to find that guy and be like, listen, you're officially not black, like you should color your skin, like whatever, but you're not one of us.
Ugochi, how about you? What's been going on this week?
Well, I was a big fan of DMX, still a big fan,
and God, yeah. I was too.
So it's just horrible. I've been listening to his music.
No, you have to sing one of your favorite songs. We want to hear you sing. What's like the song that stood out for you?
Oh, shoot, the anthem.
My favorite DMX song.
The Fighters Anthem. Dun, 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 dun. So I played basketball in high school, and that was definitely one of our songs that would come out.
Yeah, hey, that's sick.
Yeah. I think what's sad is that he allegedly died of a drug overdose. And I was just thinking of, because my story this week was Nikki Graham. I don't know if you guys ever watched Big Brother. Ugochi, maybe not. Yes. But I was a huge fan of Big Brother UK. Like, I used to go to the audition. I used to go to, not the audition shows, but I used to go to the eviction shows. And
Yeah.
For you, man.
Yeah. I'm such a fan. But yeah, it's just sad that one of the ex-housemates died of anorexia. Pain. And I was just kind of blaming COVID in a way. Like, people are going through so much stuff. Obviously, you don't know the exact details of what happened. But for you, I think the thing with COVID is that especially when you've been struggling with mental health previously, COVID takes a lot from you because you're not in control of the situation. You just know everything bad is happening around you. The news doesn't make it easier, like switching on the TV. And I think once you've been battling with mental health issues like bulimia or anorexia, you just feel, you know, this is the one thing I can control. So you even get worse in the habit. There's no one to stop you. There's no distraction. And you're just into it, you know. And then maybe like a DMX, you overdose, or like a Nikki. Oh, I love Nikki. You just kind of wither away.
Yeah. I love DMX and I honestly did not think he was going to die. Like, I was like, it's DMX. He will pull through. Like, to me, like, he's like a Superman. He's been through so much in his life. I was like, he will pull through. So when he died, it was really hard for me. For some reason, I had like, because I'm a big hip-hop fan. So like, when Nipsey Hussle died, like, that really got me. Like, felt
I didn't sad. Know Nipsey Hussle. I didn't know him till after he died. I'm so sorry.
That's all right. You have to be a proper hip-hop head to really know him.
Yeah.
But like, that really got me. But with DMX, I don't know why, but I had a lot of peace when he died.
So did I.
Yeah, I just felt like he's in heaven. Like, and I just knew he's in heaven. Yeah. And I know he's with God. I know he's dancing with the angels. I know, I just have that peace where I just know he's good. I don't know why.
He had a really good spirit, if you follow him. Yeah, a very good spirit. If you follow who he's collaborated with, their relationships, he doesn't necessarily always do things for money.
He'll
help his rapper friends out or his celebrity friends out for free. Yeah. Like, that's he had a great spirit, and that's what
definitely.
But he also had demons that he had to wrestle with every week. So it was two sides.
What's really sad about him is that he was set up. So how he started smoking crack, like, they were smoking weed. Someone laced it with crack. And he didn't even want to smoke. He's like, oh, I'm going with it. No, have one. And then boom. Like, because that's the stuff you get addicted to immediately. Yeah. And it's so sad that someone would do that to you.
It's the music industry.
Yeah.
So he's kind of just been alone in life for a long time. So the drug addiction, like, I'm not excusing that behavior, but I can see his struggles. He struggled through life, but he also had this really good spirit. Personally, you know, it must have been hard to go through life with those like two combating spirits.
Exactly.
Yeah, demons fighting them every day. Anyway, may his soul rest in peace, and may Nikki's soul rest in peace, because I love
her. She was such a polarizing character in Big Brother. Is she the one that was like, who is she?
That was Nikki.
And and then her and Pete fell in love.
Is she?
Her and Pete fell in love on the show.
Love her.
Yeah. I've heard about people dying from anorexia, but I've never like known someone. So it's almost kind of like a myth to me. So hearing that it was a lot for me. Because I was like, okay, so people really do die from this.
And you just decide not to eat. And then it's a mental health problem. Everyone is watching you wither away. Like I read the news this week and they were like, she was really trying to get to that place. And in my very like naive mind, you know, doesn't understand the problem. I'm like, yeah, but if she's trying to get, shouldn't she just put like a spoon of rice in her mouth? But I know it's not that simple at all. It's just sad. I saw her pictures, like her last pictures, literally it was a skeleton and then just slapped with skin. So back to the book. Funny enough, we're talking about anorexia and trying to be in control, you know, with all these different alternative ways. And one of our characters also had bulimia. So we'll be getting into that. So our book for this week that we're going to review is Nervous Conditions by Siti Nagarengwa. So the book basically is about Tambu, the main character, who takes us through her life and her struggles as a young child, fighting for the right to get basic education and the obstacles that she encountered trying to get that, mainly around like societal values, societal expectations, and the role of women. We see the dynamics of and the complexities of relationships between the different members of the household. And it's nice because the book shows you the different aspects of women, from the aunties to the mother's role to the senior wife, down to the daughter, you know, even things like your position in a family in terms of your siblings has an effect of the role you're expected to play in the society. All ended well for Tambu. She did receive her education, so we're kind of happy about that. It's a really easy read. It doesn't take that long. It's about 200 pages, but it's very detailed in the way it talks about these complex relationships. So yes, I recommend, based on our last book, it is a much easier read. You should definitely check it out. So I'm going to go through the themes at the moment. As I said, there were so many to get through. Like I was just taking notes on my phone till I got tired. And then when we got in touch with Rufy, she just added more light to what we had to talk about. So I'm just going to go through like five rough themes and I'm going to mention them out. And then Rufy and Ugochi, feel free to chip in. So the role of family members is the first one. As I said in the book, everyone had a role to play and it was quite significant, from Namo the brother to Tambu to Baba Makuru to the different women. So which role stood out to you? I will start with our guest, Rufaro.
I mean, for me, it was just it was a typical Zimbabwean structure. So basically, the older you are, the more responsibility that you have in the family and more that's expected of you. So my uncle is like the oldest. He's the first son. So he has a lot of responsibility and obviously people look to him and he takes that role on with pride. You know, he's very proud of that and he does really care about the family. What stood out to me about him is that he was always thinking of how to improve his family's life. Like he wasn't, some people like come up in their family and they're satisfied with like being the person everyone leans on, but he was trying to empower his own family. And I really like that. Like I like this line in this Jay-Z song when he says, "Here we say you're broke if everyone else is broke around you except for you." Mm-hmm. And I love that because it's like you should empower the people around you to also garner and to attain their own independence. And it really restores dignity in people, because when you're asking people for things, if someone has to keep asking you, like their dignity is kind of being chipped away at because they feel like they need someone else to survive. So I really like that about him. So he stood out to me. And obviously the women stood out to me. Like the main character, she stood out to me, and Nyasha, her cousin. Yeah, they were just very strong women. And I love how it's almost like they were born that way.
With that gut. We'll talk about that in a bit. Ugochi, what role stood out to you in terms of the complexities in the family and their relationship?
I have to echo Rufy and say Baba Makuru also. It stood out for me because, yes, he did a great job trying to empower his family. But at the same time, I can see the toll it played on him and his own family. So I guess I can relate, or a lot of us can relate, because some of us abroad, okay, I'll use myself for an example. My dad only had one other sibling in the US, and then it was him, and then the rest of his siblings were in Nigeria. So people, he gave a lot of money, great, and he helped a lot of people, great. But then as kids, when we start to catch on to that and we want for something like, hey, can I attend this basketball camp during the summertime? It's a no. And then my mind would go to, you've given money because this person in Nigeria wants to do this thing, you know, but what about us? So I can understand Niasha and the way she looks at her dad, and I guess her situation, and then her family, which is her cousin, and then cousins,
yeah,
mom and dad, yeah. Mm-hmm. That
yeah, you guys are positive about Baba Mukuru. That's amazing. So when you hear the phrase, "You challenge me," which you say so many times in the book, like, what came to your mind, or what stood out for you when you said, "You challenge me"?
So I don't like that side of him. That's it. I like the giving side and the side that wants to help his family. But then that other side where you're challenging me, the way he looks at women, I feel like he maybe had a bad relationship with his own mom. I don't know. I didn't see any positive things he had to say about women or positive relationships with women.
I think, yeah, I was going to say that maybe it was just that's how the society expected him to be, and he didn't know any better. It's just like when people lived in the 17th century, and to them, a black person was just a slave. Like, you need to have been a genius or be outstanding for you to realize that, no, everybody's equal. But at the same time, he had been abroad. You know, he'd studied abroad. So he's a bit unforgiving. Like, you know, his references, he was very paternalistic, and it was just, yeah, a bit disappointing. Like, and I think that's why Niasha had a very complex relationship, because I think she kept looking at him, even her mom as well. Like, you have all these degrees, you should know better in that sense. But maybe it's about thinking politically and just being, like, even if I schooled abroad, or even if I'd lived so long abroad, like, I'm now back in Zimbabwe. So when we're abroad, we live abroad.
Mm-hmm.
What do you guys think?
I think that he exuded so much toxicity, like, from the culture. I think a lot of things that in all of Africa that a lot of people are trying to change for their kids. But he really embodied that. And of course, like, the culture is ingrained in him. And by the time he went to England, he was much older to study. But still, I would have expected some understanding. Because what interests me is that his kids moved back to Zimbabwe, and he's very strict on them. But clearly, he wasn't that strict on them in England.
Mm-hmm.
Because he keeps saying, oh, you've come back and, you know, you keep taking these things that you've learned over there. But clearly the kids have more freedom there. Mm-hmm. And they're trying to continue their freedom. But he wants them to adjust and just become Zimbabwean again, if you will. But they can't, because a child has, you've immersed his culture. And I'll use myself as an example. I moved here when I was 9 years old to England from Zimbabwe. And I could speak English, but my English needed work. So, for example, my parents were like, okay, we're only going to speak English in the house and at school so your English can get better. So I was speaking English all the time at home. And if I even spoke a Shona word, it was like, no, speak in English to get your English up, right? And naturally, I lost my language.
Oh, okay.
Right? I lost my language. And obviously, like, now as older, I speak Shona more, and because I go home often. So it's in your head. It doesn't leave. You just have to kind of exercise that muscle and your language comes back. But then you go home and everyone's like, oh, you've changed. And it's like, well, I had to change, right? And people are expecting you to be then like, no, you've lost something. But I've lost my language, but I haven't lost a sense of who I am.
Mm-hmm.
And and it's very difficult. So that's why, like, I really relate to Niasha, the character, because she moved here and then she moved to England and then went back, and then she was very judged a lot. And I've been through that.
It's hard. Me as well, obviously, I've moved back and forth, but I've been most of the time in Nigeria. But yeah, I've just never felt that I fitted in. So in Nigeria, I'm always, you know, the one that came from abroad, or you don't really understand what's going on, or you're seen as a feminist, or, you know, And then over here, I'm seen as a Nigerian, my accent, you know, the girl from Nigeria. So it's very hard in that sense. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, when you grow up, I think you end up being like proud of yourself and just discover like, you know, everyone is different. Everyone is a star. You kind of live with it, I guess.
Well, but how has it been for you?
Yeah.
Question for you guys. So in our culture, I'm sure Amara, you might know someone who was sent back to Nigeria from abroad for like discipline.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Do you think that harms the child more than it helps?
Probably. Because children are resilient. Mm-hmm. And you know, like I was resilient when I moved here to adapt to the culture here. So children are resilient. It depends how old they are, but it's very damaging. Like just because they can go through a lot. Yeah. Like, you know, you see what Yasha went through when she was at the mission and people are calling her white, calling her weird, peculiar, and your kid's going to go through that. Mm-hmm. I think we need to find better ways of disciplining our kids in African culture. Because, I mean, that happens all the time. But, like, mostly when a child is disobeying, they need your attention. Not for them to be far from you.
Yeah.
They need you to be present.
Yeah.
I used to say, we'll go back to Nigeria is horrible, it's hard. There's a lot of bullying in schools, in secondary schools, like, and stuff. Like here, I'm sure it's the same thing, but Nigeria, they have this like tough love thing that happens that you don't realize it till you're grown. Sorry?
That tough love mixed with like abandonment issues.
Yes.
Manifests in a bad way, for sure.
I mean, that's a cocktail for trauma.
Mm-hmm. That is for trauma. And you don't realize it till you're much grown. And, you know, you now have the adults telling you, well, we experienced this as children and we came up fine. And you're like, are you fine, though?
you're not fine. Like, I suffer, like, from depression and, like, bipolar. Mm-hmm. And the things that I've learned in therapy about what affected me as a child, like, my mom left when I was four. Mm-hmm. Like she left Zimbabwe when I was 14, moved to England to provide for me, right? So yeah. I'm like, my mom did that for me. She sacrificed for me. Like I love my mom, right? Mm-hmm. And my therapist is like, yes, but you're the 4-year-old Jew doesn't understand these things. You understand them now, but mm-hmm. the 4-year-old Jew felt unloved and abandoned. So I have like abandonment issues and like to the point where like in my adult life, like if my mom says she's coming to see me, mm-hmm. like I would wait by the door if mm-hmm. she was taking too long and I would look for her.
Mm-hmm.
And I get mad anxiety, mm-hmm. like unexplainable anxiety. And my therapist was like, what's happening is you keep reliving her leaving. Mm-hmm. Every time she leaves you, you mm-hmm. relive that. I'm reliving that trauma. So, and to think I'm 30 now and I started dealing with these issues like probably when I was like 27 or something, like actually going to therapy. And you don't know how intricately those things affect your soul and your spirit and affect the way you are and how you attach with people, how you form relationships and like what you require from other people. Mm. So then I try to be perfect in all my relationships because my fear is someone will leave me. Mm. Mom leaving made me feel like I wasn't perfect. That's why she left.
Mm-hmm. I want to go for one of these therapy things. I want to know what I'll discover about myself. But
I think everyone should go to therapy.
Pardon?
I think so too. I've been saying it, but I just can't afford it.
It blows your mind whole. Like,
because I watched Greenleaf. There was an episode of Inyala on the show, and she was talking to the last child, Charity, and she was telling her, your mom is basically all your problems. And then they invited the mom, and the mom was like, wait. Don't bring me into this, though. I raised you how I wanted to raise you. Sorry? You've watched it, right?
No, I haven't watched it, but this episode.
I watched it.
Must have told me about this episode, yeah.
She was like, don't bring me into your problems. And I had a conversation with another friend recently, and she was like, yeah, the problem of these things, because you actually go and end up bringing more trouble if you go back, meet your parents. They were doing the best they could at that point in time. Fine, they are not perfect, but what you should be happy with a therapy session is that you've gotten some kind of reason and you can control yourself and what you do. Mm-hmm. But to go back and rehash things, it doesn't, I'm not saying it never helps, but it doesn't necessarily solve the issue, which I found very fascinating.
Yeah, but because some things will never change, right? Whatever happened.
It's never changed.
But hopefully you have people in your life that are open to healing and open to have those conversations, mm-hmm. because it sometimes it does take understanding.
Okay, that was deep. Right, so education, this book was all about that struggle to get education. I found it very funny because like trying to hustle to get into school was just never a thing. Like, and I found it interesting that in some parts of the world that hustling to even get past the door and not do household work and get into school and doing up a whole maize farm just to pay your school fees is actually a thing. So when I was reading the book, there was just that gratitude of like, there are just certain things to be grateful about in life that other people don't really have opportunity to have those kind of experiences. And yeah, so I was just asking you guys of like the gratitude you felt reading the book, whether it was about education or money or any other aspects of the character's life that you're just glad you don't have to experience in this day and age.
It made me feel guilty.
Yeah,
about what?
Because like my mum obviously moved us over here and I had education and I don't think I appreciated it as much. And I always think to myself, well, if my cousins came, maybe they would have used this opportunity better than me. I was afforded so many things that are easy, but for them, it's like their lifeline. It's to get out. Many people tell you education is freedom. I think this is one of the first books I read it and I really felt that. Education is freedom. Like this is what's going to free them, because that life they live is a hard life. And that's that they're into their books. And like in Zimbabwe, like Zimbabwe is a very well-educated country. Mm-hmm. The country is not in a good state. But if everything changed tomorrow, like everyone can get a job. Everyone has a degree. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I think at one point we were like, our education system was like the best in the world at one point when Mugabe was president. You know, because he went to Cambridge University. Education was really, really big for him, you know. So he made it like, for example, compulsory to teach in English, so like, you know, so English is easy for everyone. Like, it just, it's really interesting and it's really reflective of what the culture still is today, and that education is so important, that everyone is doing a degree, everyone's educated, but the thing is there's no jobs. And it's actually quite interesting because some of the debates that we have in our Zimbabwe community is like, all these people are so smart, but the thing that's rich in our country is our soil and it's farming. But like everyone's educated to do these jobs, but it's like we should be teaching them to farm because that's what's going to make our country rich. And it's this argument people have because, you know, everyone's sending their kids to like, people that can, sending their kids to Australia, Canada, here to study all this education. But it's like, if they just like farm their farms, they would be very wealthy. And it's actually quite an interesting debate because it's true. But then I think the world has like glamorized the other things and everyone's chasing that.
Farming the farms is good, but it would definitely not make you rich. What would make you rich is the services, the value chain, the value add from the farming. So not necessarily tilling the soil, but like turning cocoa, for instance, into chocolate and making sure that that process stays within your country. Because if everybody farmed their farms, the problem with the soil is that Zimbabwe is situated in one place. So, for instance, farming your farms doesn't necessarily mean you farm rice, cassava, and all the crops in the world. It means that because it's Zimbabwe, your soil is only going to be useful for one crop. Now, if everybody does the same thing, the value of, say, cassava or millet, millimi, I think it was said in the book, is going to be always low. So you're not rich because there's too much supply. So what you want to make sure is that once you have the millimi, you can turn that into processed foods and you have the services and everything. And then you can export it. It's complicated, but
they can definitely do that though.
Yeah, I mean, I know is that tobacco was the thing.
What? Tobacco? Oh, really? Okay.
I mean, we still have, like, that's still there. But those are the main things. And we provided that for, like, my mom always tells me that we were the bread basket of Africa. That's what she says. And yeah, like, your tobacco was, like, the main thing, I think.
Saying what would have made you guys rich is if you could actually make cigarettes. Not
Yeah, they do. So that was, So it wasn't just, there was then factories that made them. And
Okay. Ugochi, were you going to say something?
Yeah, I was going to say, I get what you're saying with the farming. And if everyone does the same thing, the price will be low. Mm-hmm. But everyone can, that could be like the base, right? The farming.
Yeah, exactly.
And then everybody can find their niche. So if everyone is is growing cassava or something like that. Mm. Hey, someone could be like a cassava. I don't know.
I know what you're trying to say.
From someone else.
Exactly.
Yeah. And it could grow from there and, you know.
Yeah, absolutely. Because also I feel like if the country can feed itself, like let's just say we can just feed ourselves and no one needs to import a lot of things. Because I've heard this statistic somewhere that is in Nigeria. I think it's Nigeria that they're the biggest imports of tomato puree.
Yep, probably. Yep.
But they have the biggest export. But they make the most tomatoes.
Uh huh.
Yep. That's right.
You need to order to make it yourself. And so if the country can just like feed itself, like I always say that we don't need the Western world. We don't need them. Like we can do it. We can just look after ourselves. And like a country like Zambia, which is next to Zimbabwe, like they made laws that are really favorable to like big companies, mm-hmm. like tax laws. So a lot of those companies have going their country and the economy is rising.
Yeah.
And I'm just like, just do that. Like, just do something.
Yeah.
Let's go back.
Speaking of farming, what was disheartening was when I read in the book, when the old woman was describing white people as wizards, and how they came in, saw a good piece of land and kind of like marginalized or pushed everybody to the margins and took the best lands for themselves. And basically that's how Jeremiah and Baba Muku ended up where they were, because their father was part of the people that were pushed, or their grandfather.
Mm-hmm.
So obviously she was basically describing colonialism and that whole period.
Mm-hmm.
But I think what was sad was when Tambu went into town and she had an encounter with the white woman.
Mm.
And the white woman was just shouting things like child abuse. In my mind, I'm like, this is how like populations are removed from reality, because there's a good story of why the white woman is standing where she is, which is that like her father or her grandfather were part of these wizards in quote that came and just just pushed everyone to the margins and came to take their land. So of course, people like Tambu and her family are in the rural areas trying to fend for themselves. So it's funny how she's been removed, like the white woman is removed from that reality, and all she can care about is saying someone is experiencing child abuse without really knowing the whole story. Mm-hmm. So that stood out to me.
Yeah, like she's actually the problem, but then she's screaming at the man like he's done something wrong. It's like, you're the problem, your people are the problem.
I wouldn't say I don't know if she's the problem, but I just
but her people are the problem, because it's like you've country and you've taken from this country.
Have you? Okay, I have a question, because Amara introduced me to this debate that happened like maybe in the 60s or something. I don't know, between high school students. Right? Yeah, remember? No, I've only watched like two of them.
Oh my God, I've watched like five.
So you have a panel of debaters from different parts of Africa, like Nigeria, Ghana, South Africa, Kenya, and the South African, and these are high school students. The South African one, the one I watched, really believes that her people are entitled to that land. And she has a different narrative than we all do of her people in South Africa and apartheid.
Is she white?
She's white, yes.
Okay.
Yeah, that's why I was hesitating when Rufy said, oh, she's part of the problem. She doesn't believe she's part of the problem.
Yeah.
Like somebody like five generations ago did that. Yeah. They're now in the land.
In the book though, like she's not five generations removed. Do you see what I'm saying?
Yeah.
Okay. Like, but obviously with this young lady, obviously she's obviously been born into this country. She's born in that land.
Mm.
And that's obviously a very different conversation. Mm. But you also have to be responsible. Like, for example, like with slavery, like the white people that are alive now, they have to answer for their ancestors, right?
Mm.
Why?
They have to, because they're the only ones.
Just being devil's advocate.
Oh, no, I understand. But because they're the only ones that can speak for them, right? Or not even speak for them. They don't have to take on the burden, but they can help make it right. Like what?
Well,
they can help make it. Like if I met someone like 10 years from now, and like I don't know, someone, my family hurt them or something, and I had an opportunity to make it right, or just to say sorry or something, I would.
Okay, Rufy, can I ask? Can I say something? I don't know where Zimbabwe stood with the whole transatlantic slavery, but I know Igbo people, which is where I come from. Mm-hmm. We were very much part of slave traders. Like we used to trade slaves. Mm-hmm. I don't know who is who, but you want me to go and apologize?
Apologize.
I'm just being a devil's advocate again. Yeah, yeah, like, yeah.
Yeah.
Who do I don't associate myself with like what happened 4 or 5 mm-hmm. centuries ago. I'm not defending everyone. I'm just saying that's why I think this conversation hits a brick wall. Those mm-hmm. people are dead. Like, what's my business? What do I have to do with mm-hmm. the situation?
But the problem is they're dead, but the problems are still persisting.
Mm-hmm.
And the problems are continuing. Mm-hmm. Because if it was just that simple, then the new generation of people wouldn't be racist. The new generation of people, the new example, whites in South Africa may be more inclusive of like the blacks in South Africa. But they're carrying on. Like, there's no change, is what I'm trying to say. So although they're far removed and they were the initial problem, they're not making it any better. They haven't had a aha moment and said, wait a minute, this is not quite right. We should be like this, or we should do this. We should progress in this way. They're not saying that. They're continuing perpetuating the racism that their ancestors.
I see what you mean. Like, you know, the black people, even after slavery in America, have gone through Jim Crow laws. We read that horrible part in Homecoming of the coal mine era. I would always talk about it because I just was traumatized by that whole chapter. The coal mine era, Jim Crow laws, the civil rights movement, down to Dante Wright and George Floyd. So
yeah, he got killed the other day. He got killed.
And this is America only. I hear like in places like South America, Brazil, even in Africa, there's still a lot of apartheid. It's just that mm-hmm. It's taking on a new form. So yeah, I kind of see like somebody somewhere is perpetuating it. It's few droplets, but it's not gone. It's not, oh, that happened in the past and this is us now. There's still that connection there. So it is a very complex.
Yeah,
because I believe there's other factors, because if I can say I'm far removed from my own ancestors who probably sold slaves, and I don't want to answer, you know, to their crimes, but no, I'm not them. And I don't know what I can do to remedy the situation now as I am, you know what I mean? So
yeah,
the other factors that continues to keep the hatred, the racism alive. What is that? I don't think that we're exploring that. We're focused on our ancestors and the past, but there's something going on now in the media, whether it be the media or other things, that continues to breed this hatred for certain.
Yes.
I think, yeah, that definitely is. And I think it is beneficial to the powers that be for that hatred to exist and to stay.
Yeah, basically politicizing things. This race report we're talking about, that definitely adds to it. You know, the political parties in power and what they do to like stir up people's emotions and just play on that wheel. You know, it could be racism. It could be other forms of discrimination. Just hammer on it.
Like what's happening in America, there is definitely like, I believe anyway, some sort of undercover, like, let's call black people in the police force thing. Because the way these people are just getting shot, like, they didn't do anything. Like, you're shooting a man that's running away. He's not a threat to you. No one's trying to shoot someone's leg to disarm them. No one's trying to shoot someone's arm to disarm them. And it just seems that there's definitely something that we don't know that's happening, because it's just so hurtful. And there's actually no change whatsoever. It's concealed, like in the words of Kanye West, racism's still alive. They'd just be concealing it. Because before, you could just kill a black person and hang them. But now all you got to do is be a police officer and kill a black man, and then you get off. Like
I don't understand. I just never understand. The guy that was shot last year that is now, I think, paralyzed, he happened after George Floyd. The police officer apparently is back to work. Mm-hmm. Breonna Taylor, nobody was ever convicted. Everybody's just back to work. So I don't know. Like, it's definitely a very difficult conversation, but I think it's important for us to put ourselves in like a normal white person's shoe who's just living their life. And every time on the news, they are hearing that, oh, it's white people against black people. So it's very important to be sensitive about these things. I always say if we were white and they were black, I think it would probably be the same. Look at what's going on in the whole of Africa.
Yeah.
Like, so it's very important to be sensitive, but just as Ugochi, like, there are other forces out there that we don't know or understand that is definitely stirring things up.
Mm. Yeah.
To me, I think at the end of the day, one thing people are not saying is just always a game of the rich versus the poor. Any other thing we say is just arbitrary.
That's it.
And yeah, and that's the thing. That's why they separate you, because they killed Martin Luther King after when he was organizing the poor man's march. Like, he was organizing for all the working class, black and white, to march to for change. And that is what they're scared of. Because if we all unite, problem. You know what I mean?
In every society, it's always the rich versus the poor. Once you're up in a certain class, all this race thing, this thing, blah, 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 it doesn't matter. You're up there. Mm. Money can buy anything and let you live a comfortable life.
What I think race really does, and I have my own views, but I'll keep it simple. What race really does to us now is it paralyzes us because we're so emotional. So we've become so emotional because of this that we can't see past it. People are always going to see someone. But when you can recognize when something happens out there, and then the news says, oh, black man, white man, you know, Chinese man, you have to see that they are trying to get to your emotions and trying to trigger us people again to get us upset. Once you can control a people that way, and we're easily controlled.
Yeah.
If we can see past race, we can see it for what it is, but not let it affect us the way it does and become powerful in the world. I'm sure these people will find another group of people.
I know what you're saying. It's just like not giving someone, like if I'm walking on the street and someone calls me a nigga, I'm not giving them my attention. I'm not going to
call
me a nigga. Like,
but you see, the media knows that. Sorry, I was just going to say, the media knows that half, like 90% of the person will never walk away. They'll video it. They'll record it. They'll report it to the news. And it makes a major news cycle.
Because it's like what you're saying, that it's emotional. I've never experienced like overt racism until like, and it's going to take a work in us. We have to work on that. Because naturally you're calling me a slave. You're calling me this. That's what you're doing. And
okay, that was deep. Right. So I always defend Namu. I think what they had as children was just more of a mix of, these are the roles expected. We've always grown up knowing this, and more of like sibling banter, obviously. And then remember, it was told through Tambu's narrative. So she was never going to be fair about how things happened.
Mm-hmm.
What do you guys think?
I know you say that, but I don't like that kid.
I don't like him either.
I don't like that kid whatsoever. And because I get the sibling thing, we had that, and when my mom moved here, like we were at my grandma's house, and it was me and all our cousins, and we had that like brotherly, sisterly like fights or whatever, but we loved each other still. Do you know what I mean? Like we used to play these games, not the stupid games like African games. We used to play these we had those things, like we had sibling fights, whatever, but there was love. Do you know what I mean? Like, he wanted to make his sister's life hell. Like, that I cannot forgive him, man. I don't care what his point of view is.
What did he do?
His sister's maize and giving to other women when she's working so hard to go to school. I would never forgive him for that. I cannot.
The other one is when he came back from school, I think, and then the sisters had to go get his bags.
Mm.
I forgot. I think that one of the sisters had a baby on her back, getting the bag, and he didn't care. First of all, I'm not saying that's a man's job, but your bags are probably heavy, right? You can't bring any of them in.
Come on, just do something. And I think, and the reason I can't forgive it is obviously I'm Zimbabwean, and our parents raised us to love each other. And like, for example, like my cousins, we're not even allowed to call each other cousins. We call each other brothers and sisters. My parents always instilled that in us. So I'm like...
Yeah, I don't know. Like, I get all your sentiments. And I think growing up, I had like a moment where I thought, I think my brother is just favored because I don't know whether it's because he's the first child or because he's the only boy. But things used to irritate me. Like, even for, like, we are only a year apart, but even things like, you know, snacks, he got like 10 naira, I got 5 naira. I didn't see why. Like, the size of our stomachs are the same thing. I always used to wonder, like, why did he get significantly more than I did when we were almost the same age? But we've grown up now and we've just kind of matured. But I think it's a more like a sibling rivalry thing. And I just thought that's where Namu and Tambu were. And then his demise was really, really kind of depressing. Like, he just died of mumps. And that was the end of... Even Tambu never even spoke about him again. Like, she wasn't even spooked going into the house where he was.
I think when you finish reading the book, that's why, like, that line, how the book starts, that when my brother passed away, I wasn't sad. She wasn't. Yeah, I like the bravery in that and the honesty in that, because I think when people die, they get glorified, don't they? Like, they were perfect, because you know, but she's like, yeah, nah, I'm sad for my mum.
I was sad
for my mum, but she was not sad for herself.
And I think the most interesting thing was, by the end of the book, her experiences mirrored her brother. Like, they just didn't want to be associated with the homestead. Yeah. They had just seen things. They were more exposed. Everything mm-hmm. about the homestead, like, made them ashamed. So I thought we were leaning towards, you know what, my brother was an asshole, but I understand where he was coming from now. She just never, ever referred to him after, oh, yep, he died of mumps. And yeah, I've moved to his spot. That was cold. That was
cold, yeah. But she was over it. Like, she was over it. She was that very much, she was marginalized. She didn't get what she needed, what she thought she deserved, and she didn't. And he was a blessing for her. It was, because she's the one that then had to go to school. And from what I know of her, I think she's now, she has a few degrees, and she, you know, she followed through.
Is this an autobiography? Is this a real life story?
Yeah, it's real life. I'm pretty sure it is. I think this...
I kind of got that feeling it was.
It's almost like a memoir, isn't it?
That makes sense.
Yeah.
Because I always just, I think one thing that I felt every book was that we were just in her thoughts quite a lot. And I was just like, where's the action? I don't want to be in your head all the time. When she was in the car going to her uncle's house, and then when she was returning to the homestead, I'm like, this is like 3 pages of us knowing your thoughts. We are not interested in that. But if it's a memoir, then completely understand that. Right, we can explore that, maybe.
Semi-autobiographical novel.
Did you read the book too? I know there's a book too.
No, yeah, I want to read the next book.
Yeah.
I want to see where it takes.
Yeah, okay, so second to the last conversation is about the women. This book was just filled with characters of women.
The women.
So Rufy, who stood out for you and why?
Obviously Nyasha, because she just, I felt like I was reading about myself, just
understandably.
She moves to England and then goes back. Well, I haven't officially gone back to Zimbabwe, because I just go to visit. I try to go every year because it's just the best. But yeah, and just some of the things she's went through, I went through, and just like her, the audacity of her, that with, like, I said that in a positive way, the audacity of her, like, to stand up for herself, to believe, and not even to believe, to know that her opinion matters, and to fight for opinion. Because I went through that as well as a child. I had so much, I had so much to say. And I'm sure this is the same in all African cultures, but you're not meant to have an opinion. If your parent says something, that's it, end of story. The conversation is done. And I was never satisfied with that. I was like, you will listen to what I have to say. I am happy to follow the discipline, whatever it is, from my parents. Like, if they say, don't do this again, I won't do it again. But can I just tell you what happened? I want you to understand why I did something. Because you can feel very, like, villainized and very, like, you're just naughty. Like, you just did that because you're naughty and you're being disobedient. But it's like, I wanted to explain so they would understand and give me more grace if they understood where I was coming from. Funny enough, saying that, it just makes me realize why I'm a very understanding person. I always need to know the why. I don't like judging people. And like I always say, I can't even understand a murderer. Like, if someone said to me, oh, I killed someone, and I'm like, okay. And then they're like, oh, but they raped my mom. I'm not going to look at you as a cold-blooded killer. Mm-hmm. You know, I was always trying to get my point across, and she's the same. You know what I mean? She challenged her father. I challenged my father. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? I did it. My father was abusive to my mom and to my brothers, and not to me. And I would challenge my dad, and he struggled with that. And funny enough, the word challenge was the trigger for him. Just like it was. Exactly. It's like, he'd be like, you're challenging me. You're challenging your father. You're challenging me. It was this thing. Like, you can't challenge him. And it triggered him to the point where he became violent. And it's actually interesting, like we were talking about therapy before, like, and me having the conversations with my dad, I understand him more. So when he was younger, he didn't know his dad. And so anything he did wrong, people would be like, oh, you're a bastard son. And he was challenged a lot or made feel a lot of way when he was younger. Because he's a strong man, he's like six foot four or something. He's really tall. Mm-hmm. Like a strong black man. So anyone that basically he felt disrespected by, he just hit them. That was worth coping. So he gained respect and fear that way. So that trickled onto how he was raising his kids. The challenging thing was like, you're challenging me. And then he would get violent. But I still was not afraid and still would challenge him and tell him he was wrong. So I relate to her so much. And I admire her courage. And she's so mature for a young woman. Like when her mom leaves the father for like the week she left, she was understanding. She's like, sometimes you have to do that.
Yeah.
She was able to discern between her mother's love for her and her mother's need to grow as a woman. And I thought, amazing.
Yeah, at that age, I don't even think I'll understand that. And yeah, you're right. She was quite mature for her age. Okay, so we've heard from you and Yasha. It's quite a good analysis.
Yeah.
How about you, Ugochi?
So my favorite character is Lucia.
Oh yes, yeah. Lucia.
Yeah.
I want to really go in deep about her. So go, because she's fierce.
She's very fierce. So my favorite part in the book was when all the Baba Mukuru and all of the siblings were having that meeting about their cousin, and obviously their cousin and Jeremiah, which is Tambu's dad, are messing up, right? They're both sleeping with the same woman. But Baba Mukuru and the rest of them don't say anything about that. They don't say like, hey, you've messed up, you're the reason. Instead, they're blaming the women, right? And Lucia is like, oh, okay, so all of you guys are gonna be quiet here. I'm gonna go say something. And she did. And she went in there and she got a cousin by the ears, I think.
Literally dragged him by the ear. Do you know how embarrassing that is?
That's a very classic discipline move in Zimbabwe. My
in
mom.
Nigeria as well.
My mom.
And then there was this hot flush, you know, horrible. Absolutely horrific.
And she did
It was a powerful moment because she walked in on him lying about her.
Yes. So at that point, as he's lying, what is he going to do? Because the person he's lying against is right there and she knows the truth. So like a deer in headlights.
Mm-hmm. I think there was a quiet admiration that Baba Makuru had of her because he gave her a job at the end, took about 2-3 days to arrange things. He just didn't want her trouble. I don't know what he was, but I found it. He didn't resist. He just said, yep, this is a good solution. Let me get you a job. So I think there was that quiet, like, do you know what? You're the only person in this family.
Yeah, he admired people that wanted to do something for themselves.
Yeah,
he liked that, and I think because it took the burden off him.
That's very true. I didn't think about it. The one person that I think stood out for me as a woman is the mom. Sorry, I don't know her name. Tambu's mom. So I don't.
She was my nini, but like, yeah, that just means.
Yeah, it's fine. I can call her my nini. Like, I just feel she's not that sort of woman that you kind of overlook because you'd be like, you know, she's right into the system. She's just playing her role. But she had a lot to deal with. Her two kids died. So the one she had when she got impregnated by Jeremiah at first, and then Namo died. And then she was basically losing her, like the emotional trauma where my second child is put in the exact situation of the first child that died. No one is explaining anything to me.
Yeah.
And everyone is just letting her walk through. And then you watch your daughter also change towards you. No one is asking for you for your opinions. It's just, she's just that woman, like the village woman that we are going to be embarrassed about. She had a lot of strength. And it's just a bit sad that you know that her situation would not improve in any way. Mm-hmm. And I like the fact that she was fighting back a bit, obviously being rude to Meguru. Is it Meguru? Yeah. You know, trying to let her voice be heard, also like talking to her daughter and stuff. I mean, she wasn't heard, but it's just a very dark and sad situation. But I thought I should mention her because she's just one of those characters.
She went through a lot. This husband of hers was just useless.
Yeah.
I like how you saw people that were given the opportunity to be helped and they took it. And then you saw people that were given the opportunity to help. They were just waiting for some. Do you know what I find interesting, actually? Sorry, something just came to my head. Right. Do you remember when Baba Mkuru comes back from England,
uh-huh.
and then he says to Jeremiah, his brother, like, mm-hmm. oh, you know, I'm glad that you did the right thing, that the money we sent you used for school fees.
Yeah.
And he didn't, did he?
He did not.
Because he did not use it for school fees. No. Because otherwise she would have been going to school. And we never addressed that. Like,
yes.
he was obviously bad with money. Because when his daughter, you know, made her £10 to go out to school, he tried to go and get that money.
Yeah.
And, you know, he got his wife at a young age. And I feel like she was trapped with this man. But I don't think she even really respected him. He was just happy to be carried.
Yeah, and I wonder about that. So there are two things. So I was going to say, like, I don't understand the situation where everybody ignored the fact that he slept with two sisters. Like, so when I come to have sex with my husband after he's just impregnated my sister, how does he work in the bedroom? That's number one. And then number two, I just wonder with his relationship with Baba Mukuru, where if there was this Mukuru, sorry, if there was this hidden thing where Baba Mukuru was probably feeling guilty that he was the one they sent off to the missionary school while the other children sat back, and he knew from that day, like, his whole life he's going to try and make up for that. And if the brother was just happy to ride on that.
Yeah, I think Baba Mukuru is trapped in that sense.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And that's why he feels this, you know, he helped his family to detriment of his family.
Mm-hmm.
Like,
yes.
You know, and because I think he felt that, like, survivor remorse, like, I survived, I got the opportunity, yes. they didn't. You know, he felt guilty. But then some people don't want to be helped. They're not taking the help, you know. Because I wanted, at the wedding, didn't he say he was going to give his young brother his house?
Yes.
So if this, in this sequel, I want to see what happens with that.
Yeah. If he'll stop giving money after that. Like, hey.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, if you have your own house like that, you're going to have to figure it out.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. All right. So the last point, the need for control, but we kind of addressed it in the beginning with COVID and everything and everybody feeling helpless. And that's where your habits kind of exacerbate because you're like, this one I can control. Like, this is what makes me happy. This is why I'm going to be control. So if it could be through alcohol consumption, it could be through drug overdose, not eating like Nikki. And then in this book, I found it interesting that by the time Yasha started signs of bulimia, like, you could almost understand she was trapped. Like, that kind of, this is my family. I can't move. I am the daughter. But I don't have anything in common with these people. What they're saying to me is Chinese. I am in prison. Mm-hmm. So by the time you got there, you know, from her experience, I kind of understand what people going through these kind of decisions go through, and just the need to control something, whether it's harmful to them or I just, it really puts it in a lot of perspective for me. The need to control, but it's also the need to, I think, be heard.
Yeah.
Be heard in that way.
Yeah, because she wasn't being listened to.
Yeah.
I mean, one of the things that I love the fact that she punched her dad back. Like, the way he was hitting her from the description, it's like he was really, like, hitting his daughter. And, like, I imagine him to be a large man. I, like, in my head, he's that tall. Yeah. And, like, and the fact that she punched him back, I was like, that's something that I would do. And I was just like,
wow.
I'm going to hit you back. And I love the fact she just stood up for herself. But she was trapped and her mind, it was going to go a bit crazy. And, like you're saying, she had to find something controlling. What I found really, really interesting is her relationship with Tambu, and it's Tambu's observation of her when she comes and her dress is too short and she thinks, she's and it is the classic thing that happens to you.
Yes, when you go back home.
When you go back home. Because I have a relationship with my mom and I'm like, mom, I don't want to do that. I can say all these things. People are like, oh my God, she said something back to her mother. How dare she? And it's like, yeah, we're good. Like, we're good at it. Oh, we work.
Keep going.
But yeah, I found that so interesting because she admired her cousin so much. And it's very interesting. Mm-hmm. Towards the end of the book, she's starting to get the courage. She starts reflecting on how she's actually been marginalized and she's accepted it. And that her obedience is actually her being silent and her allowing to be, yeah, herself allowing herself to be silent and not to have a voice. She started to learn that. And it's what it takes. It takes something in her that sits, does not sit with the spirit. Her parents get married, does not sit well with her spirit.
It
completely discombobulates everything inside her because it's attacking who she is and her family, because she feels like we're really saying we're less than. We've been a good family.
Yeah.
But we have to get married to become official. I'm not okay with this parade. Mm. And knowing what her mother has gone through and her starting to get a voice, that those feelings were so strong that it birthed her voice.
Said,
I'm not going to this wedding. I'm not going to this wedding. And I just found that so powerful, because I think sometimes whoever we are inside will eventually come out.
Yeah.
You now have to speak for yourself.
Yeah.
She was no longer just going to be grateful and not do anything. That was a proud moment for me, for her.
Right. Does anyone have any last words? What you liked most about the book? What stood out for you? Or should we move on?
Well, I want to say this. Nyasha, obviously, they go to a disco in the book, and then she has the encounter with the boy, and they're like dancing or teaching each other some new dances.
Yeah.
And you know, this is what leads to her father hitting them, because her father calls her a whore, which is absolutely unacceptable and horrifying that he called his daughter a whore. But what I find interesting, and I think it's similar to other African cultures, is that you grow up and you basically get told, don't talk to boys. You're encouraged never, ever, ever to talk to boys, right? Not to have that interest in them, you know? And then you grow up, you go to university maybe, and then suddenly every time you see your family, where's the husband? Where's the husband? Where's your husband? So I'm like, when is he coming? And it's like, you've told me all my life not to associate myself with these people.
Talk to boys.
Now I'm supposed to have a husband. And it's so backwards, right? Because we're not prepared for it. Right. And I feel like all these conversations, the whole point of being a parent is to pass on knowledge. So it's like you should be telling your daughters and your sons, this is how you get a woman. This is how you approach a woman. This is how you, what you see in a man. This is how, like, there should be a lesson.
About sex.
But you're not talking
about sex.
You're not talking about
menstruation.
Exactly. And then all of a sudden, you're supposed to find a man. Now it's like, you should do your hair. But the way Nyasha was looking after her body in terms of, like, she wants to look cute. She's a fashionista. She knows what she has to dress. All those things are negative. But now you're older, it's going to be like, oh, do your hair nice so you can get a man. It's just so backwards, because you discouraged that. Yeah. And some woman would have buried that inside them.
Yeah.
And then now you want it to be rebirthed. And it's like, it's so unfair and it's so backwards. And I just want that stuff to be deaded in my culture. I don't want that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I voiced that, and I think it's crazy, because luckily it's not just the African culture. Like Bridgerton, did you guys watch Bridgerton?
No.
I've been told to watch it.
What? How have you not watched Bridgerton? Yeah, oh my god!
I need something to watch.
Anyway, so one of the big themes in Bridgerton was the relationship between the main character and her mom. And, you know, the fact that, as you said, Rufy, there was always this rush, like from the beginning to the end, all the mothers were hustling to marry their daughters to, like, the dukes of the town. And it was all about, what are you wearing? Let's, like, tighten your corset. What are you doing? You must act like a lady. And then the main character was like, okay, now I've entered. And she didn't know how to have sex. She didn't know how to get pregnant. And then she was like, she had to, I think she ended up having to ask her servant, like, what's going on here, or something like, what do I do? She asked her servant a funny question. I don't remember what it was, but everybody was just stunned, like, okay. And then she had to confront her mom. She was like, what's going on here? You didn't tell me all this. You just sent me off, had a party that I got married to a duke. No one really explained anything to me. And she went on and on talking about it, and I was like, wow, this is quite profound, because we always say African culture, but this is everywhere. Like, there's just that gaping hole of, like, things not being explained, especially female issues.
When did that show take place? What era?
18th century. In the 17th century. So
maybe it's because African culture is kind of still old.
It is.
Yeah, maybe.
Yeah, your parents don't talk to you about anything. So then, like, they also have an expectancy to now you share with them. It's like, we didn't listen the way you started this year. We didn't share. So now you want me to start talking. I have nothing to say to you. You know,
I'm no, not but capable. I know that, but at the same time, can you imagine your parents being, because I always say that, oh my God, with my daughter, I'm just going to like, even be in the same room with her, her first time having sex, because she just needs to know stuff. But at the same time, like, yeah, it's an embarrassing conversation to have as a teenager.
It has to be had though. It has to be had. Because I want to know, obviously, like, I want to try to teach my daughter to, like, I'm not raised a Christian, and obviously don't want her to have sex until she gets married. But teach her to love her body, to know that she deserves pleasure, and how to, because there's a lot of things that I find, like, sexually, just even having my voice in bed. Like, do you know what I mean? Having a voice in the bedroom with, like, your partner, like, being able to say what you want. It's all so foreign. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
We're also taught to please the man, so you kind of just do what the guy wants. But, like, I think from my experience with women and all my really close girlfriends, like, it takes time for the girl to actually be like, actually, I like this, I like that. It takes us a minute. And I'm not saying you should talk to your daughter about those in-depth things, because that's also part of her growth. She can discover that. But she should definitely have a foundation from you of what to expect, how to say no. Like, the confidence to say no, that, like, one of my best friends, Rachel, she always says these things that I love to guys. She says to them, even if I'm naked, if I then say no, it's a no.
Yeah, it's a no.
I've had situations where I feel like I've wanted to change my mind, but I'm like, oh, I've gone too far, I can't change my mind. You know what I mean?
So, yes,
like,
no, it's not just me, it's everyone, yeah.
If you want to love my daughter, no matter at what point, you can say no.
Definitely, I agree with that. Yeah. We'll strive to do better than our parents. It's just funny, like, we say all these awesome things, and I have, like, friends who have kids now, and, you know, the dynamics, like, the relationship I have with my parents was so much different from our generation. So I think in the sense we're trying, it's just be interesting to see what our children complain about.
Exactly. There's a lot of love in African family, like, a lot of love, but it's not expressed with words.
Okay, so I'm very excited about these next two parts. We're almost ending. Rufy,
yes,
tell us something we need to know about Zimbabwe, like, in terms of a myth that is not necessarily true, or something, a fact that people don't really talk about that we non-Zimbabweans should know, or something you've heard about Nigeria that resonates with Zimbabweans or doesn't.
Well, if I think of my people, Zimbabwe people, I love the country. Love the country. Like, when I go home and I land, I am emotional. I'm happy when I smell the soil. Like, it's everything.
Sorry, let me ask, how long have you spent in Zimbabwe at any point in time? Like, what's the longest time you've spent?
So, like, obviously my life from when I was born to nine, but
apart from that, now,
like, 3 weeks at a time.
I beg you, that you're not suffering. My sister, let me break it to you. It's always different when you go on holiday.
Oh, it's always different. Oh yeah, I know that. I know that because I see
my friends. Sorry, carry on. I cut you off.
No, it's okay. No, that's the whole idea, you know, back and forth. The thing I love about Zimbabweans, they are such, everyone's an entrepreneur. Like, they are such hustlers. Like, everyone, like, in everything we've been through, they're so resilient. Like, they're a very resilient country, very resilient people, and everyone's trying to make money, and everyone's always figuring something out. And I love that about them, and nothing really gets them down, you know. Like you're saying, it's hard, and I see my family going through it, and it's like, I try to bring some joy when I go home and try and do things for them that they can experience, like, not some hardships, because there's always a time of the day where the electricity's gone out, whatever, but they're just really resilient people, and they're really good, they're really business-minded people. You know, I pray for my country, and I pray for the opportunities to come, because I think it will flourish so much. Hopefully things change. Yeah, and the thing that I feel really strongly about, and it's not a positive thing, and I hope no one, like, kills me for saying it, but I think we are a very, very passive nation, and that frustrates me. Because I feel like with everything we've been through, like with Mugabe and stuff, I just feel like in another country, there would have been like an opposing there would have been civil unrest, mm-hmm. people that would have fought hard to overthrow the government. And I just feel like we just let things happen to us. And if things mm-hmm. are changing now, and the young generation have more to say, but I wish my people were more aggressive about their freedom and about, but it's going to cost lives, of course, and people don't want to do that. But I think we're a very passive nation, and I wish we weren't. Yeah.
Yeah, it's interesting. I love this part of our podcast because we hear about so many other countries and what they think about themselves. Like last time it was Kenya, and they said something interesting, which is that the guy said they were more like silent sufferers. So it's interesting that you're now saying that you're passive people, and we were going back and forth. And obviously, Nigerians are a bit aggressive. But is there any other like, fun fact or any other thing? We Nigerians, as you know, we criticize ourselves a lot, so this is a safe space.
Zimbabweans are drinkers, like they drink, like they're like heavyweight drinkers. Like men will drink from like the morning to like night, and you won't really know that they've drank. They just can handle their liquor. Like they drink a lot, and I actually think we have a nation of functioning alcoholics, and I think it's because we don't have therapy. Like there's some really fun, interesting facts about like mental health in Zimbabwe. There's like not enough like therapists. It's like one therapist for like 100,000 people or something like that. A lot of people are like undiagnosed with things. And I think like, but we're drinkers and we have a good time. We know how to have a good time. No matter what is going on, no matter how bad things are, we know how to have a good time. We have fun. Like that is something you will never miss in Zimbabwe. Like you will... People know how to party. People know how to get together and be with each other. Yeah.
Would you ever go back to live in Zimbabwe?
I would love to. Yeah, I would love to go back and live in Zimbabwe and give back to my community, to my
country. That's not the question. Would you ever go back?
I want to.
I would love to go back.
I want to go back. I want to go back. To be honest, there are things that hold me back. And
yeah.
I've been spoiled, like living in a
of course.
You know, just things like the bank, like they can just take your money. I just can't deal with that. Yeah. Like I always think about practically how to do it. I probably need to have like international accounts, and
or you go back like as an expatriate, like a lot of money. Because that's what we always say. Like you can go back to Nigeria,
I need to have I need to be set financially
in every currency possible. Then you can go back, like a king.
Exactly. And then I can help people out.
So our turn. So I don't have Zimbabwean friends. I don't think I've so I don't have a lot of Zimbabwean friends. So I don't really know that much about Zimbabweans. But apart from Nigerians, I think you're the next African country that I've seen that is a bit out and about and like, you know, just everywhere in the UK. Yeah, I know my sisters went to school with a lot of Zimbabweans and they were the people that they had to bond with because there were not a lot of Nigerians, but there were like Zimbabweans around. And you find out that we were all quite similar, like in terms of the energy we bring.
Yes.
And then another thing about Zimbabwe I know is Makosi. You can't, I love Big Brother. Do you know Makosi?
I remember Makosi. Of course. Big Brother,
ever listening, I was such a fan. So that's another thing about Zimbabwe.
She was an old woman. I like her.
Yeah. I follow her on Instagram now. She's calmer. But yeah, she's gone through a lot of stuff. Like she had a cancer scare. So she's a bit more, you know, level-headed, but still the same energy.
Yeah,
so that's
beautiful. She's so beautiful.
Yeah, she is. And then the third thing is just Mugabe. Like, obviously, coming into this country was the peak of when, like, the UK absolutely hated Mugabe. And there was a lot of, like, trading bans. So there was, I just got this sense that, you know, they were, like, a poor African country that was under this dictator. And their inflation rates were ridiculous. Like, it was 100,000%. But the way you're describing it now, like Mugabe had good times. It's just, an African dictator.
Yeah, like the saying goes, like absolute power corrupts absolutely. And that's why people need to have served terms and leave. And I think that he served for so long that he lost his way.
Yeah.
I'm grateful for him because he did do a lot of good for our country.
Good to hear, because we never hear that in the news, because I followed the mainstream media and they hate Mugabe, and I'm just like, it's not possible. Like he has a lot of followers. It's just that I don't know the story enough to make a judgment. So, Ugochi, how about you? What have you heard about Zimbabwe, like, ever?
Not much. Just Mugabe, that's it. But bad things about Mugabe. So, like, the other day I had to go in and research, because now I'm seeing that people like to villainize certain people to, like, a bad degree. Where...
Exactly. It's like, tell the whole story.
Yeah, tell the whole story. So
the beginning.
I no longer go on like BBC or Wikipedia or things like that to get stories, because now I understand, you know, what they do.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so I learned a little bit more about him this past week.
Mm-hmm.
It's good. He started off good.
Yeah, he did. Yeah,
and then kind of tapered off, but he did do a lot of good.
Mm-hmm. He did. He did.
Okay, so Rufy, your turn. What have you heard about Nigeria that we should address?
So I have Nigerian friends. So I'm better than y'all. I'm joking. My first boyfriend was Nigerian.
Oh, how was that?
God, was he a Yoruba demon? Oh my God, sorry, my God.
He was born in England, so like he's very British, if that makes sense.
Doesn't matter.
But yeah, so I have a lot of Nigerian friends, and I made a lot of Nigerian friends at uni as well. So
Okay. Obviously,
very passionate about their country. I love that. Mm-hmm. They're very passionate about their country. I love jollof rice, but I do think an angel of rice is better.
During whatever. Do you guys have jollof rice in Zimbabwe?
We don't.
I'm going to forget you said that any other jollof rice is better. I'm just going to forget. Like, you were bold enough to say it on this podcast. I'm just going to forget.
Actually, one of my exes is from Sierra Leone, and his mom's jollof rice is the best jollof I've ever had in my life.
I
need to reconnect with him and get the recipe. Yeah, like all good things, like men get a bad rep.
Mm-hmm.
Like the Yoruba demon thing. I only learned about the Yoruba demon thing like 2 years ago. I know the main tribes are like Yoruba and Igbo. Is it Igbo?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and Hausa.
Yeah. I know like education is very important in Nigeria. Mm-hmm. I know like they're very proud people.
Yes.
Very proud people, very proud of their children. Like their children are like their trophies. You know what I mean? They like
really
lift them up. Yeah. I love Nigeria. I love Nigerian music, obviously. Like Wizkid is like my favorite Afrobeat artist ever. Obsessed with him. Yeah.
Is there anything like different that we do that Zimbabweans don't do? I mean, apart from I don't know.
It's quite similar, isn't it?
Yeah. Like apart from Nigerian people. Is Zimbabweans that I know are very outspoken and out there in the UK.
We're everywhere. Like I grew up in South London, which is in Essex, and there's a strong Zimbabwe community there. There's like a lot of people. There's a proper big community of us. And there's a lot of Zimbabweans in Luton. Yeah, we're everywhere. Mm-hmm.
Okay, so we are quite similar. So the last segment is about Rufy, is all about you. Tell us about what you want like our audience to know, our growing audience to know. Thank you for listening to this point.
Thank you so much for inviting me. I've had such a good time and really enjoyed reading the book, and I'll obviously become a regular listener. Mm-hmm. And I'd love to come back. If you guys want me back, I'd love to come back. So I'm very passionate about mental health. Because it's something that I've been affected with, and I always feel like it was my intention to be affected with it, because I was one of those people that grew up like strong-minded, like you can't be sad, just make yourself happy sort of thing. And I honestly feel good was like, I'm going to show you what it's really like so you can really try and explain it, because I'm very good at speaking and stuff like that. So I'm very passionate about that, and I'm passionate about sharing the struggles of mental health, because I feel that a lot of people don't share the struggle. Like you hear after the fact, I was depressed, but I did the work. But I like to share the journey because I think it's important for someone.
Thank you for that, by the way.
To see that thing. So I have a website called Rhythm of Life.
Okay.
I have not updated it in like a year. I need to really work on it. Okay. But
if we post it in our description center.
Yeah. So it's www.rhythmoflife.com. Rhythm of Life spelled with an E, with a 3, not an E, because I couldn't find the domain. Like, but yeah, so it's just me kind of sharing my journey, my mental health journey, and kind of sharing the bits that I've learned that can help other people. And obviously, I'm a writer. And I want to be a documentary filmmaker. I'm going to start work on my documentary this summer, doing documentary on absentee fathers, telling that story.
Very interesting.
So I'm going to start research this summer, and hopefully in a couple of years I'll be done and someone will pick it up and I can share it with the world and tell the story and kind of offer some healing for people.
All right. Thank you. You were so good in just cooperating right from the beginning. You bought the book before I could even say Jack Robinson. So that was really great. So thank you guys for listening to AfroReads Podcast, another episode. Please follow us on all our social media handles at AfroReads Podcast on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. And we'll see you on the next show. We will announce the next book in our social media handles as well. Take care and have a good week.
Bye.
All right.